Case number 14-7171 et al. Milan Jankovic, also known as Philip Zepter, appellant, Phil Point BV and United Business Activities Holding AG versus International Crisis Group, a nonprofit organization et al. Mr. Smola for the appellant, Mr. Sullivan for the appellees.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Rodney Smola for Philip Zepter. Your Honors, there are two important issues in this case, the private figure or public figure status of Mr. Zepter, and the question of whether there's sufficient evidence in this case to warrant submission to a jury on the issue of actual malice. In deciding the private figure, public figure status of Mr. Zepter, the Supreme Court's decision in Gertz versus Robert Welch and the other three decisions that followed Gertz, as well as this Court's own distillation of those Supreme Court decisions in Walbaum versus Fairchild Publications, provide us with the three-part test that have to be applied. Walbaum is not only the long-established law of this circuit, but it is a test that has influenced and been adopted by federal courts and state courts across the United States. It requires three things. First, that the court isolate the specific public controversy. Second, that the court evaluate the prominence and centrality of the plaintiff's role in attempting to influence the outcome of that controversy. And finally, a prong that has not gotten a great deal of attention from this circuit or the courts, but that is especially important here, that the defamation be germane to the plaintiff's participation in that controversy. The public controversy in this case is most appropriately understood as the state of reform, political and economic, in Serbia after the tragic assassination of Zoran Djindjic. That is what the report at issue here, ICG Report 145, says it is talking about when it describes its purpose in writing the report. And that indeed is how this court in Jankovic 2 described the focus of that report. More significantly, thinking about how people read reports and digest information in our society and what the point of the Walbaum test is. When we see a television program on 60 Minutes, when we read an article in the Washington Post, when we read a report by a group such as ICG, and it says, we're here to talk about this subject, we want to focus your attention on what the state of reform will be now that Djindjic has been assassinated. And in the course of that discussion, someone is defamed, in this case an extraordinarily serious defamation, a claim that he had been involved as a corrupt crony of a prior brutal dictator. Naturally, one assumes that there must be some connection between that defamatory statement and the overall focus of the report, which helps us understand what the controversy is that this person must somehow have entered.
Why do we assume that the scope of the report defines the scope of the controversy?
Your Honor, it's certainly not a lockstep notion, and we're not trying to make a mechanistic four corners argument. But what Walbaum says is you've got to try to connect what the plaintiff's role is, what the defamation is about, and what the pre-existing public controversy was. And so the natural center of gravity is, why is Mr. Zepter mentioned? Why is this particular point made? It should have something to do with what the report is about, and that's
so. Your point's well taken in the following sense: that the fact that he's mentioned in the course of the report certainly suggests that he has some centrality to the subject matter of the report. By definition,
and that's true. That's the point I'm making.
But I guess that doesn't seem to me at all to be the exclusion of a public controversy. That's much larger.
I agree with that, Your Honor. I think that's where the interplay of the three Walbaum factors come into play. And I think it's not so much the scope of the public controversy that this first issue in this case turns on. It's how you then play out the other two factors in relation to it. And
So then, just to go a little further, so then on the scope of the public controversy, your brief takes the position that the scope of the public controversy should be focused temporally on the period post-dating assassination.
That's the position we take. And the district court expanded it to at least when Milosevic was gone in the year 2000. So it takes into account the Jinchuk years.
And it's sounding to me like your argument, though, is, I know you don't want to abandon your argument, but the focus of your argument is not on temporally restricting the
Correct.
Scope of the public controversy. It goes more towards
exactly,
your mainness.
Exactly, Your Honor. That we win, which no matter which controversy you pick, how broadly or narrowly you assign it, Mr. Zepter ought still to win. The court in Waldbaum was extraordinarily prescient. It's a very rich opinion. And there are two footnotes that I think are enormously important as you think about how these factors interplay. In footnote 32, the court really thought about, anticipated this sort of case. The court talked about what we might think of as the near miss, in which you have a person that has achieved a substantial level of success, maybe a level of celebrity in an arena. But they're not so famous as to justify being called general-purpose public figures. And the court said, you might think then, you'd automatically drop down to limited-purpose public figure. But that's not the rule. You could go all the way from not qualifying as a general public figure to being a private figure. And I bring that to the court's attention because that tells us that Waldbaum, like Gertz itself, insisted on two different analytic methods here and that the limited purpose public figure test be interpreted with rigor. Footnote 27 is also enormously important in understanding Waldbaum and our point here, because the court there said controversies might be defined in large ways and small ways. There might be expansive definitions of public controversies or narrow ones. And the court in Waldbaum seemed to say we're not taking a position as to how it ought to be. We're not dictating policy, saying that bigger ones are better or smaller ones are better. But there are consequences to the choice. If you define the controversy expansively, many more people will be caught in the net. There'll be a lot of fish in the net, but it's much harder to become a big fish. The plaintiff's prominence in that controversy will tend to be diluted. If it's narrower, it's more likely that the plaintiff may play a central role, but then you may have trouble on the germaneness prong because you may not be able to connect the defamation to that plaintiff's role.
So that's how I should read your brief, I gather, in terms of your emphasis on really, insofar as your client is concerned, it's only that post-Dinchuk assassination period where he has any, what I'll call, limited public figure status.
Correct, Your Honor. That the sort of celebrity quality, to the extent it comes, seems to come almost after Jinchuk and not have much to do with anything that's involved in these political affairs. I think the core of our submission.
Well, there's a lot of materials about his association with Jinchuk.
There's a lot about his association with Jinchuk, but the defamation is not about his association with Jinchuk. And there's nothing during that time period in which Jinchuk is being criticized. Of course he is. He's the head of state.
Right.
Zepter has come into on the radar screen of folks, and he's being talked about. But what's missing there is any suggestion in any of that discussion that Mr. Zepter had anything to do with Milosevic and was ever a corrupt crony of Milosevic or was in active alliance with him. And really, I want to strongly emphasize the germaneness prong. It's never really been stress-tested by this court, and there's surprisingly little law on germaneness nationally because it's almost always obvious. In the prior cases that this court's had involving the public figure controversy, it was easy. It was plainly germane in Tabula Reis. It was plainly germane in the Clyburn case. There was plainly germaneness in the Lawrence case involving the fighter pilot. But in this case, on both a common sense level and a theoretical level, if Waldbaum is going to be conscientiously applied and if Gertz is going to be conscientiously applied, you ought to hold that he's a private figure. And here's why. From a common sense point of view, for him to be a public figure, the court's got to accept this equation. It's got to say a person who was doing business in Serbia in the Milosevic years and not flamboyantly, not out there, not involved with the government. There's nothing in this record to suggest any connection with Milosevic during those years. There's nothing to suggest that Zepter has a high profile in business even those years in Serbia. He made his money elsewhere in Europe, and he's just beginning to enter Serbia at the time Milosevic comes in. So you're doing business and you're managing to hang in there and succeed and keep it going while Milosevic, this evil dictator, is in office. Then a reformer comes along. And now, for the first time, you step out of your role as a business person and you decide to embrace the reform. And you say, this is a breath of fresh air. This is the rule of law. This is democracy. Then this is what we need.
So I need to understand a little bit here. We're on summary judgment. So this interpretation of the evidence is viewing it most favorably to your client.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because I assume counsel, Appellee, will point us to all of the discussion about these oligarchs. And, of course, your client had a lot of money and potentially could have been such a person. And given some of the press statements about him, and I know you challenged that, but isn't that enough to bring him in? I mean, he may not have wanted to be, but he was the subject of general conversation.
Your Honor,
his bank didn't just hang on. You know, it prospered during this.
Yes, Your Honor, but there's a lot of law really emanating from Gertz that says entering into society's business and culture and other aspects of life, law in the case of Elmer Gertz, and just doing your job is not enough to make you part of a specific controversy. Okay. And I think there's like a strong parallel with Gertz. Elmer Gertz was a well-known, famous civil rights lawyer in my hometown, Chicago. He was an activist. He was dealing with accusations of police brutality by the Chicago police, sadly something we still deal with there and across the country. The Supreme Court said he is a private figure with regard to an accusation that he was a communist. Well, there's a lot of resonance there in terms of this case. Mr. Zepter was doing business. That doing business cannot by itself have made him a public figure for the purposes of this case. He then does embrace Jinchuk. But Gertz tells us and Walbaum tells us that's not a bad thing. We want to encourage people to enter public life, and we want to be careful about what penalties we saddle to them. And it does it in two ways. First of all, Gertz distinguishes between generalized participation in the polity and the specific entrance into a specific public controversy. And says we want to be sure that there's a sense of what did you take on when you entered into this fray. Mr. Zepter took on critiques about his relationship with Jinchuk, critiques about his relationship with Ambassador Denton. But out of the blue comes the accusation that a person apparently he never met, never knew, never dealt with, was not corruptly engaged with, that he was a corrupt crony of that person. And if the thin reed is this noise that's out there, which Your Honor has just talked about, that some of these oligarchs might have been hangovers, our submission is that's not enough. And there's a second theoretical point.
You say it's a thin reed. Why is that a thin reed? Because I take it that I accept your argument that the connection to Milosevic is something that pertains to actual malice. So we'll get to the question of whether there's enough indication of a connection with Milosevic to make the assertions in the report actual malice or not. But if the report says there were people who had associations with Milosevic, we'll take that to be true for now. Those people, everybody expected that there would be reforms and that kind of nefarious contact would be dissipated because of the reforms. That never happened. Those people stayed connected. Look, here's an example of somebody who stayed connected. And then it's also true that he's a public figure for purposes of his connection to the next regime. Then that just seems to stack up.
It's our position, Your Honor, and I think the right position, that what's missing is some pre-existing buzz, some pre-existing report, some pre-existing notion that Zepter himself was somehow connected to that Milosevic regime, and now he finds himself here with Jinchuk. Not just that Jinchuk may not be the reformer he claims to be, or there might be some people that were connected to Milosevic, because in effect it's saying everybody who was in business during the Milosevic years and didn't get shut down and then later comes back and participates in the Jinchuk government, guess what? You're a public figure with regard to anything connected to what you did during the Milosevic years.
Everything you're saying goes to actual malice. It's not that whether you're a public figure with respect to Milosevic. It's just, suppose that you're just a public figure with respect to Jinchuk.
I think it goes, Your Honor, to what risks did you assume when he became involved with Jinchuk? And did he assume the risk that he could be gratuitously out of the blue with no other prior discussion of this or hint of this or buzz of this be accused of being connected to this war criminal? And in Gertz, and I'll move on to actual malice because I know the court wants that. In Gertz, the court reminds us that we're not only trying to not penalize people for entering public life and entering the democracy, but that there is another value of constitutional dimension. The court quotes Justice Stewart from Roosevelt versus Bear and says, you know, reputation is part of the essential dignity of any human being. We have war-torn areas of the world that are trying to emerge and become places where there's democracy and the rule of law. It is rough business to say if you have been doing business when your society was torn and then you enter into and try to be supportive when things are starting to go well, you open yourself up to claims that you were connected to a war criminal. That's a rough understanding of what the private figure, public figure dichotomy ought to be. And the better view, in my view, the one that's more preservative of human dignity and better calibrates what we mean by entering in the arena is to treat him as a private figure, as hard as that may seem to be, given someone with Mr. Zepter's success. Turning to the actual malice question, this is, as the court's already said, a motion for summary judgment. And so while Mr. Zepter has the burden at trial of proving with clear and convincing evidence that there is actual malice, ICG has the burden of negating that and saying there are no genuine issues of fact submissible to a jury in this case. And Mr. Zepter is not only entitled to all of the inferences in his favor, he's entitled to their aggregate impact here. Now, in this case, there is an elephant missing in the room. In every Supreme Court decision in which actual malice has been at issue, and in every decision of this court in which actual malice has been at issue, there was a source or there were sources that were identified that supported the defamatory statement. You go back to Associated Press versus Walker, AP had a reporter on the scene. You go back to Curtis versus Butts, there was a source that claimed the football game had been fixed. In Curtis versus Butts, the Supreme Court said there was still actual malice even though they had a source. St. Amant versus Thompson, there's a source alleging the corruption. In Hart Hanks versus Connaughton, in which again the Supreme Court said there's enough evidence to go to a jury on actual malice, there were sources that supported the story. In this court, there was a source for the Washington Post in the Tabula Reyes case, one source, George Comas. In the Clyburn case, there were three sources, one a little shaky, two the court said were solid, it was enough. In the Lawrence versus Donnelly case, there was a naval aviator on the USS Abraham Lincoln providing the information to the defendant, leaking documents to the defendant.
Are you drawing a distinction between confidential sources and non-confidential sources?
Confidential sources are entitled to zero weight, Your Honor. They're entitled to zero weight.
Period, as a matter of law. No confidential source can ever be
used by a defendant to negate actual malice at the summary judgment stage. There is an analytical difference between the right of a defendant to withhold the identity of a source, either under a shield law, like the D.C. shield law, or under a common law or First Amendment privilege that might be recognized, but that's analytically distinct, and the courts across the country, state and federal, have said you cannot have your cake and eat it too. You can't invoke the legal cards you may have to keep the source identity secret and then say, I don't have actual malice because I've got this confidential source. And in all those prior cases that I cited to you, Your Honor, it wasn't the confidential source. There was an identified source or sources. And then the question was, could you still have actual malice notwithstanding the existence of that? Here, the story begins with the preconceived notion, an assumption, not a source, that if you were doing business in the Milosevic years, you must have been, what the defamation says, a corrupt crony in active personal alliance with Milosevic. In Jankovic 2, ICG argued that defamatory statement was an opinion, So in Jankovic 2, it didn't even claim that the defamation here was a factual statement backed by a source. It said we were just expressing our opinion that that must be what he was. The court properly said, no, the opinion defense does not protect you. Now there's a pivot, and they say, well, it's our assumption. But to say it's an assumption is actually itself enough to get to a jury on actual malice, because when you say we made this based on our theory, our assumption, you're confessing you don't know. You know you don't know. And so then the question is, well, if you knew you didn't know, what else is there in this case? And there's really two things. There's our affirmative evidence of indicia of actual malice, the kinds of things plaintiffs always rely on in these cases. And then there's the emptiness of their attempt to negate it. So we've said, look, what did you do after the assumption? Well, you know, one of the first things they claimed they did was rely on the Serbian press reports, which, Your Honor, you've already talked about in relation to the earlier part of this case. Now, here is an entity that holds itself out as the gold standard in investigations on these serious policy issues. And they say we're better than the embassy reports. We're better than what you get from the government experts around the world. And then they say, but we don't have actual malice because we took these press reports that we have described in our own document here as bordering on libel, as sensationalist, as unreliable. And that's the basis for our defamation. And what's worse, those reports themselves don't even say that Zepter was a Milosevic crony. So they're taking the kind of bad noise and atmosphere and name-calling that's out there about Zepter and saying that was one of the things that buttressed our argument that this is a corrupt crony of Milosevic. There's evidence in the case that we think the district court very wrongly ignored. The evidence of the extortion. The district court said that evidence of an extortionist attempt by Lyon may be reprehensible journalism, but it's at most ill will. It's at most common law malice, and that's not constitutional actual malice, so I don't credit that in terms of the ability to go to a jury. And that alone is reversible error, because it's plainly the case that evidence of ill will, and particularly this kind of extraordinary evidence of an extortionate effort to shake down someone and to say, I'll stop writing about you if you pay me off, that may not be evidence of knowledge of falsity or reckless disregard for truth or falsity, but it's highly probative of it. And just as in the first panel in Tabula Reis, the court pointed out, motive and intent are different. A motive to commit murder is different from an intent to commit murder. The motive is highly probative of the intent. And then there's the inherent improbability that Zepter would become a close friend of Jinjic if Zepter had been a personal crony of Milosevic. There's record there's evidence in the record that as you would expect, Jinjic had Zepter checked out to make sure that he was clean, and he checked out fine. It would have been extraordinarily reckless of Jinjic to associate himself with a personal crony of Milosevic.
You need to wind it up, Mr. Smola.
Yes, Your Honor. If I could just get to a couple very quick points on the negation case. The ICG brief heavily depends on a number of things that they say help us establish that there was no actual malice. One is the OFAC report. In this court's prior decision in Jankovic 2, the court said not a word in the OFAC report, not a word, that's this court's phrase, buttresses the suggestion that Zepter benefited from Milosevic, let alone supported Milosevic. And the word supported is in italics in Jankovic 2. And so to say we assume that he was a bad guy and then we rely on the OFAC report, which not a word supports it, is not enough to take us away from a jury. And then my last point, Your Honors. In this court, ICG resurrects the OHR report. The district court appropriately held they could not invoke the OHR report because of judicial estoppel. There's evidence in the record that it's a fraud. At best, it's a big jury question of everything surrounding that report. It certainly is not enough to negate actual malice. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Sullivan.
Good May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Sullivan on behalf of the Appellee International Crisis Group. This morning I'll address a number of the points raised by Mr. Smalla and questions that were posed by the court. But first I want to begin briefly by just taking a step back. This case has been before this court twice previously on preliminary motions that were directed to the complaint. Following those two appeals, a single passage remains that the court found could be defamatory, could convey a defamatory implication. That's what we're here on. And much has happened since we were before this court last 6 years ago. Discovery in this case has encompassed two continents. Discovery has taken 3 years. Depositions, there have been many, and there have been tens of thousands of documents produced. Following that extensive discovery, both sides moved for summary judgment and submitted an extensive record to the district court. The district court faithfully followed this court's teachings in Waldbaum and Tavlareus and first determined Mr. Zepter to be a public figure. The record was replete with evidence that Mr. Zepter did indeed voluntarily insert himself into the public controversy concerning Serbian economic and political reform.
So defining it that way almost makes everybody some type of non-public figure. I mean, if you raise your hand almost, that can't be the test.
It is not.
So everybody has tried to narrow, and indeed Report 145, where, as you say, this single phrase exists, didn't do that.
Your Honor, the thing here is, let's talk about that first part of your Waldbaum test, which was also teachings in Tavlareus. The first step, what the court has to do, is roll up its sleeves and determine the nature and scope of the pre-existing public controversy. The district court found that the public controversy regarding Serbian reforms began with the ouster of Milosevic.
All right, but there's language in the Supreme Court's opinion in Gertz that can be read to suggest that you look at the defamation, the alleged defamation, in terms of how it's defining the nature of the controversy. So to say that, you know, the controversy is what happens in Serbia, you know, in the 21st century, you know, what happens in the world in the 21st century, that can't be the test. Here we're talking about a specific point in time, and the question is, at least in my mind, being faithful to Gertz, and counsel saved me the trouble of recounting some of the factual statements in Gertz. I mean, you had an extraordinary situation there of a very prominent figure, and yet the court didn't go as far as your brief goes.
Your Honor, I would tell you that I think you don't look at Gertz, you look at the teachings of this very court.
Well, this court purported to be following Gertz.
It did.
It quoted it time and time again. It was very careful, and indeed, it had to be consistent with Gertz.
It did. And Gertz laid out general principles, and this court has been faithful to those principles.
So all right? I'm talking about applying those principles, all right, and whether or not here, and I think Judge Srinivasan's questioning suggested that, except your broad definition of the controversy, but I don't think it's quite as broad as you just stated it here today, even in your own brief.
Well, here's the thing.
Then look at the second two steps.
All right. Would you like to, should we talk about the second two steps?
It's your time.
All right. Here's the one thing I would say to you, Your Honor. And that is, when you talk about defining the public controversy, before we move to the second step, one of the things the court does is it looks at what the public discussion and debate have been. That's one of the things the court has to get a handle on. And you cannot, as the plaintiffs would have you do, look at the challenged article. And so, that is clear if you look at what the court did in Waldman.
So what I'm trying to understand is, in Gertz, Country was very concerned about the infiltration of communists within our country. All right? That's what Gertz was accused of. All right, here, this man, who made his fortune outside of Serbia, and as I read the record, was an established billionaire before this period, what the record shows is there was discussion about him, but the question is he a public figure? Has he asserted himself into this controversy at the time that this defamation is referring to? In other words, just take a hypothetical. You know, suppose he's a sleepy shop owner living quietly on a farm, and then Milosevic is not reelected, reform movements come, and he becomes very active in that. But that's not what the defamation is about.
Well, Your Honor, I think it would be helpful to take these, to go through the process.
Okay.
Let's look at the voluntary participation, which is one of the things that the plaintiff contests. He said, well, I didn't have sufficient voluntary participation in this controversy. And then lastly, Your Honor, we're going to circle back and talk about germaneness, which speaks to your concern about, well, how does this defamation relate to this person's role in the controversy? So what you do when
and
you're
defining the for the purpose of this subsequent discussion, you're defining the controversy as?
Yes, I'm defining the controversy as the district court did in this case.
So post-Milosevic, the status of economic and political reform post-Milosevic.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
That is correct. So what you need to do to define whether he was a voluntary participant in the controversy, and let me say one thing before I jump into that in detail, and that is, Judge Rogers, this speaks to your concern about Gertz. What this court did back in Waldbaum and then reiterated in Tavlareas, it said you have to look at the two touchstones of Gertz to be faithful to Gertz, and that is precisely what this court did. And to do that, you look to whether the person pursued a course of conduct that invited attention and comment. You look to whether the public figure enjoys access to the means and the channels of effective communication. That's what you do. You try to see whether this person has the ability to mitigate harm. So that's what we do. These are fundamental, basic, old concepts, ancient concepts, not just constitutionally based, as the court set forth in Gertz, but fundamental tort principles of foreseeability, assumption of the risk, and mitigation of damage.
So look at how Waldbaum defines this. I mean, that's what you want to look at. It says, quote, the language of Gertz is clear, that plaintiffs must have, quote, thrust themselves to the forefront, close quote, of the controversies so as to become factors in their ultimate resolution. They must have achieved, quote, a special prominence in the debate. So that's the language of Gertz that we have adopted in Waldbaum.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right.
And so, what the court does, what
you say, the voluntary participation that's consistent with that standard.
Exactly.
And what does that show here?
And here's what that shows. What that shows here is that this plaintiff, Mr. Zepter, did indeed have access to the media. Press interviews and profiles, frequent mentions in newspaper articles, an open letter to the Serbian people all show his ability to respond to charges. He clearly was able to get his side of the story out. He inserted himself.
Isn't it clear, though, that a person who speaks out to defend himself, you can't use that defense against him as a basis for saying he's a public figure, can you?
That is not correct, Your Honor.
All right.
You can't. What you cannot do is this. The Washington Post cannot go out tomorrow morning and say Michael Sullivan is a bad lawyer and charged me with all kind of heinous conduct. And then to make its defense, every day for the next 2 weeks, they run an article on the front page of the Post about me. That is bootstrapping. That's what the court has said. No, we're not going to permit that for good and valid reasons. Okay? That is not Mr. Zepter. The ICG comes along late in the game. All manner of things have been said about this man prior. It's got nothing to do with us. That the courts have looked to and said, we can consider that.
So
and we can
are,
consider.
Are we looking for some evidence of voluntary participation other than his support for Mr. Dymchick?
Indeed. His voluntary participation, let's talk about that a little bit. Here, he was an active participant in Serbian politics as early as 2000. He was outspoken in his support of the Serbian reform movement. He was a close confidant and political patron of Mr. Dymchick. He advised the prime minister. He says, I was his close friend. And he spoke out for Dymchick early and often. And here is the key, Your Honors.
So the answer to my question is yes, that his voluntary participation is his support for Prime Minister Dymchick?
Among many things.
Well, I want to get the among other things, and I can't get that. The defamation is that he was a crony of Milosevic.
Right, and we will come to that when we talk
about
it.
Can we come to it now?
Your Honor, it's the germaneness prong is where this court has seen fit to address that.
But we're talking about his voluntary participation such that he was, allegedly, this crony of Milosevic.
Can I give you the rest of the evidence of voluntary participation? Because I think it will give you some comfort. The key piece of evidence here, and I don't see how one can get around it, in terms of voluntary participation, Mr. Zepter writes an open letter to the Serbian people, which is published on the front page of two Serbian papers. And in that letter, he takes on his critics. He says, he tells the folks that he entertained political aspirations himself, and you can't go out there and publish an open letter to your countrymen and say, I'm like Judge Rogers, your example of some little small businessman, you know, quietly going about his affairs. You're
so people who write op-ed letters to the press?
That would be a significant fact that this court has in its past taken into direct account. You're not just sitting there being quietly going about your affairs, trying to have an effect on public issues, matters of public significance.
But you yourself described it as he was taking on his critics. He was defending himself against these charges.
Absolutely. But he did more than that. He also, when you talk about voluntary activity, he put his money where his mouth was. All right? He goes out and he lends early financial support to the reform movement. He bankrolls the Serbian government's entourage to the United States to the tune of over $100,000.
This is the lobbyist.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. This is the lobbyist when Dymchick is prime minister, right?
It is.
Okay. I understand that evidence, all right? What I want to see is what is there about him during Milosevic?
Well, what is there about him during Milosevic? As Judge Srinivasan said, it goes more particularly the way it's been organized here in terms of the evidence of actual malice.
Right. So can I just to understand the analytical framework?
Yeah.
So the way you conceive of the case is that there doesn't need to be a showing that Zepter was a public figure with respect to Milosevic, because that's not the way the public figure part of the inquiry is constructed. You're saying that the controversy is post Milosevic, the way you conceive of it. So by definition, it doesn't matter if he was a public figure with respect to Milosevic, because we've already defined the controversy to be something that postdates Milosevic. And as long as on the germaneness prong sweeps in Zepter, notwithstanding that the report deals with Milosevic. So if the report only dealt with Milosevic qua Milosevic, then you'd have a tough case. But the report deals with Milosevic and his after effects. And so then that brings you back into the picture, even though the public figure part of it only deals with post-Milosevic. So your point is that all of the Milosevic stuff goes to actual malice, not to public figure, because the report, although it's pegged to Milosevic, deals with the status of reforms post-Milosevic as well.
That's what it's focused on. What this court has done, you're exactly right, Your Honor. This court has said, look, we got to see whether it is fair, whether it is proper, whether it is just to hold somebody to this high standard. And did they insert themselves into some kind of a public controversy? If you find that they did, then you turn to the defamatory statement and you say, was that sufficiently germane? All right? Now, I will tell you, having labored in these vineyards.
Now, suppose the allegedly defamatory statement said nothing about post Milosevic, that all it was about was cronyism during the Milosevic regime. Well, then you'd have a hard sell on germaneness.
That's a fair point, because what it was talking about is that the same folks that were there under Milosevic, you know, Judge, it's like the old Who song, won't get fooled again, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. It's like nothing has changed. These same people that are pulling these shenanigans are still there under the new regime. And how can the Serbian people possibly hope?
But I think you need the nothing has changed part in order for germaneness to work in your favor. Because exactly. If the piece didn't have anything to do with nothing has changed, and it only dealt with Milosevic, then Zetter might have been a public figure, the ultimate public figure with respect to stuff that happened under the next regime, but it wouldn't have anything to do with the report.
That is fair, Your Honor.
Okay.
And what I would say to you, one last brief thing on germaneness. This court, if you go back and you look at the public figure decisions of this court, starting with Waldbaum and moving up through to the present, what you will see is this court has labored long and hard on the first two elements of that test, and typically you get to germaneness and you have one paragraph. In Waldbaum, it was six lines long. And you say to yourself, well, why is that? Why is that? Because in truth, look at what the court said. The court goes through all this. They say, was this person in a public figure? By God, he was. Was it through voluntary participation? By God, he was. Okay, now let's look at the defamatory statement. And what the D.C. Circuit has said, they've looked to see whether the defamation was, quote, wholly unrelated. And Waldbaum itself, the last line of the six-line paragraph on germaneness, the court said, quote, misstatements wholly unrelated to the controversy do not receive the New York Times protection.
Do you see the first sentence of that paragraph?
I have that, Your Honor.
Yes. The alleged defamation must have been germane to the plaintiff's participation in the controversy. So I think that's why my colleague says it's critical to you, to your argument, that you're talking about this post-Milosevic period, and that you get to define this public controversy very broadly.
Yes, in your teachings, I mean, this court has on numbers of occasions set out a broad public controversy. Look at Tavlareas. It was the oil industry that, you know, what was going on in the energy crisis in the oil industry. And then it set out a very narrow public controversy about nepotism that was engaged in that the Washington Post wrote about there.
You don't want to cite that case.
What's that?
You don't want to cite that case, because that's a very narrow public controversy. Nepotism. He put his son in charge.
The nepotism piece was, but the broad public controversy was huge.
Okay.
The other thing is,
can we go to actual malice for a second, or unless there's, I don't want to take us prematurely to actual malice, but if we're at the point where we're talking about actual malice, then the question is, the assertions in the report tying Zepter to Milosevic. As to that, what's your view of the extortion part of the case? Because it seems to me that extortion would tell you that if extortion was the motive for writing something, then the way you would frame what you're writing is not having necessarily anything to do with the truth of it. You'd be framing it in order to get the biggest extortion demand you could get. So why isn't it probative? Why isn't the extortion probative of whether the report was done with the proper amount of inquiry as to its truth?
Your Honor, I think we have to, I think you have to look long and hard at that whole extortion business. And in fairness, I think it is an 11th hour measure to try to, like, pull this case out
of the
fire.
You could definitely make that argument to the jury and persuade them that it never happened. But let's just assume that we have to assume that it did?
No, Judge, let's talk first about is it pertinent as a legal matter? That's the first question I assume that is of concern to you. So let's look at that. Here, it's irrelevant as a matter of actual malice. And the reason that is because even if you were to credit Mr. Zepter's claim that he met with Dr. Lyon at the Geneva airport after the publication of Report 145, it would not serve as evidence of actual malice as a matter of law. As this court explained in the McFarland case, the actual malice inquiry is concerned with the defendant's state of mind at the time he published. Here, by Zepter's own claim, this happens months after the piece is published.
No, but the meeting happened months after, but why doesn't that say that the extortionate motivation could have been in existence for a long time?
But he doesn't say
you wouldn't expect him to. You wouldn't necessarily expect it to have come to light.
But that's not what Zepter testifies. Even if the meeting took place then, at most it's evidence of ill will and common law malice, which this circuit said in the Tavlareas case. Those bad motives do not constitute evidence.
Well, that's what I'm not understanding, because it seems to me that whatever ill will means, of course it's evidence of ill will in some sense, because extortion is a thing that we don't like. But is it probative of whether the piece is truthful? And it just seems like if we credit the testimony that extortion was in play, and let's assume that the extortion was in play at the time that the piece was being developed. Okay? Because I think somebody could make an argument and say, hey, I met with somebody, they tried to extort me, I'm just going to tell you that must have been in place before. Let's just assume that for present purposes. If that's true, then it just seems like if the motive of the piece writer is to, the writer of the piece is to get money, then that's what's going to fuel them, not the truth or falsity of what they're saying. They're going to try to figure out, how can I get the most money? One way to get the most money is, I'm going to say the stuff that's going to scar the most. And if I say the stuff that's going to scar the most, I'm going to be able to get some money out of this. Is that not, what's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that, Your Honor, is what this court has taught is evidence of ill will, it only matters if you're going to try to harm the person through falsehoods. Here we have evidence that and this is out of Zepter's own mouth, that he was not trying to harm him through falsehoods. If you look at the testimony, Zepter says, and I'll give it to you so that you have it directly.
Yeah.
Zepter is asked. He says he testifies that Lyon believed that what he published was accurate and based on reliable sources. Here it is, Zepter. I asked him, now, can you tell me why you were writing lies about me and why you don't stop, I suppose, in this sense? He said, but I have reliable sources. I said, you don't have reliable sources because it's not true. It's lie. Everything you've written about me, it's lie, except my name. He said, okay, that's that. And I believe that's true, he said to me. And ICG counsel says, I believe what's true. He believes what he is writing is true. Zepter testifies, yes.
Right, but I get that. And if that meant that Zepter believed him when he said it was true, that would be one thing. So it may well be the case that their exchange was to the effect that Zepter asks him, you know, why'd you do this? And he said, well, I think it's true. Then all we know is that he told him that he thinks it's true. We don't actually know that he thought it was true, right?
But that's all you have, Your Honor. And whether Zepter believed he believed it's true, that's beyond actual malice.
But then all we have is that he said it was true.
But that's all you have.
Right.
You don't have any evidence to the contrary. There's no evidence in this record to the contrary.
Extortion. He was trying to extort. It wouldn't be terribly surprising, I think, that somebody who's trying to extort a subject wouldn't fess up and say, by the way, I know, wink, wink, everything I'm writing about you is false. He would probably say, you know, I think it's true, but I'm trying to extort you, and I'm, whether it's true or not, I'm writing the worst stuff I possibly can so that I can get the most money from you. I think it's true. And then do we just credit that, and we have to take him at his word that
he believes it's true? But, Judge, if this was a scheme to say the worst things about Zephyr you possibly could, mm-hmm. I don't think you'd go about it by putting it in a list of all these folks who were Serbian oligarchs, all right? I mean, there were other things out there. If you look at the record, there's an allegation that was investigated by Parliament in Serbia that the guy was part of some political murder of a defense official. You put that out there. I mean, you wouldn't have this vague thing that, like, look, the same folks that were under the old regime are still in power under the new regime, and we can't get political change in the fashion
that we should. So as a matter of law, you're saying no reasonable juror could find, taking all of the evidence, including the evidence of extortion, a finding of actual malice.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Even if would you say that even if the standard wasn't clear and convincing?
Right.
Yeah. No, but I mean, the standard is clear. Well, I don't know. I haven't thought about that, to be honest with you. But, you know, the standard is clear and convincing.
Right.
And given that the standard is clear and convincing, this doesn't pass the bar, and in light of the court's prior teachings.
Because a lot of what you're saying about why we should discount the extortion part of the case seems to me to be a perfectly good argument that you could make to the finder of fact to say,
right.
You know, don't credit that. That can't have been really what was going on. It didn't come up till the 11th hour. You know, all sorts of things that would say, A, this didn't happen, and B, even if it did, it's not even close to being a big deal. But that's different from saying that as a matter of law, no reasonable juror could find that there's evidence of actual malice here.
Right. The thing is, Your Honor, what I would say to this court is I think when you look at the record of how this came up, when it came up, late in the case, you look at what was going on there. He says this took place in September of 2012. He gives a press interview in which he goes after ICG Hammer and Tong and Dr. Lyon, making all these claims. At that point, he says that ICG was in league with Bugljub Karic, an admitted member of the Milosevic regime, okay? And he says that's what was going on. This is a matter of days after this purportedly happened. I say to you that you need to think long and hard before you permit an 11th-hour claim like this to defeat summary judgment in a case. I think the risk there is substantial for great mischief in an area where what this law is intended to do is protect robust, vigorous debate on important public issues.
So is your view then that no reasonable juror could conclude that the extortion in fact happened because of the way that it was raised? Is that the point you're making, or are you making a different point?
No reasonable juror. I think if you look at the entire record, but I can't say that no reasonable juror could conclude that. I think it unlikely, but I think your sounder ground on which to stand is that this just doesn't measure up to evidence of actual malice. But I just say to you, it is highly suspect, and I think you run the risk of unleashing a very dangerous dog if you go down that road. But if your honors...
Let me ask you, do you have any more questions? Judge Ryan. All right. Time is up.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
You have more time. All right. Mr. Smollett, how about 2 minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, to your line of questioning, Judge Rogers, we contest the view that the self-defense principle is limited to things defending mm-hmm. yourself against ICG. It's clearly much broader. The court said that in Clyburn. When you right. defend yourself generally against these attacks, you do not become a public figure. Judge, I think you perfectly articulated ICG's case on the private figure issue. And when you came down to the end, I think the fulcrum of the case turns on whether or not the nothing has changed claim is good enough to saddle Mr. Zephyr with public figure status. And Mr. Sullivan's right. There were six lines your prior discussion of this. I hope you take six paragraphs or six pages this time. And this is the opportunity to explain what that really ought to mean. And if you explain that germaneness prong in light of Gertz and the values of Gertz and the other Supreme Court opinions, it ought not be enough. It ought to be nothing has changed plus. And the nothing has changed plus should be some prior connection with Zepter, not just generally there's these oligarchs and is it that way, because that makes this much too broad. And just my final point, going to the actual malice point, I think you're absolutely right that these are jury questions, and it's not just the extortion motive. A reasonable jury could find, looking at this whole picture, they started with an assumption, they deviated from their own practices, they relied on a report that doesn't have a word to support it, they used this 11th hour OHR report, flipped back and forth on whether it means, and it could have been an obvious fraud. They rely on biased reports from the Serbs that don't even make the point that they're relying on, and then they invoke confidential sources. We're entitled to the aggregate of all of those, and this court, if it has any doubt, shouldn't throw it out. If it has any doubt, having come this far, should let the finder of fact hear this, and then you have a record to review to decide, now that it's all been brought through that crucible, is there enough to sustain a verdict of actual malice? Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Call the next case.